My name's Edith. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, it's really a privilege to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction, and that 50 spot helped. I really am so grateful to be here and in this crowd of fine people that you've assembled, but I want to, just like has been done by other folks up here, thank the people who put this on and everyone who's showed up, because you've created the fellowship that I crave, and for that I'm really grateful, and welcome home is perfect. You know, I've been to meetings in a lot of places, and in January I was at Cape Horn on a boat, and that's at the bottom of the world, and a lot of people drinking on that boat I happen to be on, and a French crew, and asked the woman at the desk, hey, will you put up a notification about friends of Bill? And a woman showed up, and we had a meeting, just the two of us. And I was so sick, because it's the roughest seas in the world. Some of these fishermen and whalers or whoever was on this video earlier might understand. So I was over the side a few days. But we had our meeting, and during the meeting, I had to get a garbage can over to the side of me, but we kept going on. So I'm telling you that story because I was home on a boat in the seas outside of Antarctica, and that's what you've given me, that kind of fellowship, that kind of unity. And you'll get it wherever you go, to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's a real privilege to be here in your company tonight. And it's a real privilege to have been asked to speak here. You know, Harlan and Zan kindly called me in advance, and I know there's a lot of other people who underwrite this thing. But I'm telling you, your hospitality has really been almost unparalleled. I'm just waiting for Cirque du Soleil to show up in my room. So, because everything I could have imagined has been afforded. My husband Richard, who's here with me tonight, and me. So, you know, I'm pretty low class, so to have this kind of treatment is really really dear. So thank you for your hospitality. Also, I'm from Alabama, and hospitality matters, you know. So I'm a grapevine devotee. Since the day that I got sober, thanks to a loving God and sponsorship both ways and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of church basements, I hadn't had a drink since the first day of June 1987, and for that I'm truly grateful. So this is the latest grapevine. I love this. Pigeon duty. I have 43 years in the program, and on going through some of my old papers from 1975, I came across an old phone message from my 12-year-old daughter. Her name is Julie. I thought it was awful clever, and I wanted to share it with the grapevine readers. The note said, "The AA office called, Daddy. You're on duty for pigeons from 5 to 7 p.m. So be sure and take your binoculars in a bird cage." Love, Julie. That's about it, isn't it? So boy, Madeline, who I've gotten to know, stayed up with me late. I appreciate that. Cliff, who my husband underwrites, which means he's severely impaired. These are your earlier speakers, all of whom I think very well of. Lucinda, also known as Larcine or Lorraine. Her husband asked me to cede some of my time to tell you that he really was pushed down the stairs. I happen to actually be named after a town in Scotland. My last name's Peebles. My father's Scottish. I'm three-quarters Scot. And we all the Peebles visited Peebles, Scotland, 20 miles south of Edinburgh in 1998. And They wrote about us in the newspaper. There's a lot of drinking that went on. I was sober, and I'm just telling Larsine in advance, if they'll let my family into Peebles, I know they'll let you in, baby. A short note about Peebles, Scotland. I was there, and I had about 10 years of sobriety, and I'm with 15 of my family members, and we had had some great planned events. My father and I are the lowest class of this set of relatives, and my daddy often looked like he was homeless at some of these places that we were staying. They'd ask us to please give us their driver's license. My great uncle, who has a little more class than us, they had a car for him. But daddy and I, they'd ask us what our last name was every time we'd pull up. But anyway, we visited with professors from Edinburgh, and we had traveled both in London and in England and all over Scotland. And we had our Thanksgiving dinner in 1998 in Traquair Castle, and it was quite a great time. But after about 15 days with all my relatives, who every evening were drinking, and then they started having a few Scotch tastings as things were going on, I really was desperate for a meeting, and I had the international directory with me because then I didn't have the immediacy of the internet. And I called up, and they said, well, we're going to send a man around to fetch you, and his name is going to remain confidential. And I said, okay. And I said, I'm at the Peebles Hydro Hotel in Peebles, Scotland. My name's Peebles. They said, well, he'll be down there right about 7:30, and he'll be whistling. I said, okay. So just like Butch talked about last night, my old man, my daddy said, hey, where are you going? I said, I don't know. Who are you going with? I don't know. Where are y'all going? I don't know. But anyway, this cat came and got me. His name was Ernie. He was on the redundant, in Europe. He was on Social Security disability, and the reason why was because his stomach was almost gone as a result of alcoholism. And he'd been sober, and he'd been taught to help out fellow alcoholics. And he came and fetched me, and gasoline was pretty expensive then for him, particularly $2.75 a liter. He drove all the way in from where he lived, fetched me up, drove me all the way into Edinburgh. We were gone from about 7 p.m. till midnight. Every person in that meeting talked to me about how they'd gotten into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was from the States and a new visitor to their meeting. And then we had some tea and some scones. And then Ernie and I got back in the car, and he drove me all the way back to Peebles, which was a rough road back then, and that traveling was about an hour from the meeting. And then he had another hour and a half to travel back home. And when we were departing, I said, Ernie, what can I do for you? You've been so good and kind to me. And he said, Edith, all I want you to do is call me before, not after, even overseas. I've still got that card of that guy in Peebles, Scotland on that night who gave me that kind of kindness. And again, that's what I hope you'll always see in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you are me, and I am you. And that's what's happened here. We become a network. If you become a part of this, become a part of this fellowship, you're going to be in a network that'll keep you in with us, joining our hands, to the point where nothing's going to take you down, We're going to be there with you. God is the overseeing force in that network. And it's what we say when we speak to the word we instead of you alone. And that's been a great opportunity for somebody like me who always operated alone with very poor and crummy results. I just wanted to note, too, that, there's a reason Butch gets held up in customs, okay? And you can figure that out. And Steve's an old friend of mine. I texted him this morning and said, look, I can come up here at 10:30 if you're still sick. And he said, no, I'd rather suck at 10:30 than at tonight. So You go on up there tonight. And tomorrow is a guy named Mike. And all I can tell you about him is he's a friend of a guy I grew up with named Billy Wayne, okay, who I used to go to Talladega with. So, good luck tomorrow. I was saying my prayers when Richard and I were, right before we were coming up here, saying my meditation, you know, trying to get silent. And I always say the same mantra, God be in my heart, in my head, in my tongue. And so that's what I bring you tonight, hopefully, that God will be in my heart, in my head, and my tongue. I'm not always that thoughtful or reflective, okay? I'm all about me. You know, Sandy Beach says the material world is where we look at what's in it for me. Spiritual world is what's in it for them. It's usually what's in it for me, okay? And that's how I typically operate. But what you've taught me to do is, you know, look at the newcomer and cheer them on, okay? And I slowly saw that happening as time passed when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, I was hoping for someone else's good. I'd never done that before. You know, you were either user or usee. And I mean, I sucked people's blood, and it went fast, okay? So if I lived with you, it's your money is our money, and my money is my money, okay? You get that? And if I went out, you know, if I was living with you, then that's how things operated. I got some new lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous. I you know, if I was living with somebody, I was always available, okay, for anybody else who came along. Another lesson I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, fidelity, new word for me. What is fidelity? I remember posing that to my sponsor. What does that mean? Had a lot of meanings. About being true, about being having integrity in Alcoholics Anonymous. But all that was foreign to me when I got here. And all those lessons of how to be the best Edith that I can be are what you've taught me through working the steps and what I've learned from sponsorship. You know, I was talking to my sponsor yesterday, and she's pretty to the point. And I really appreciate her. She's from England, and she's Jewish, born on Christmas. But you know what we're about is a God of your understanding, okay? And that was really important to me when it was when Steve was talking about that today. I can't tell you how important that was to me, because when I was growing up in Decatur, Alabama, my mother was an evangelical Christian, and my mother was just a unconditionally loving woman. And I think about her very often, because July 29th is the day she came into the world and the day she left. And she left drunk, died from alcoholism. My mother at the end of her life was drinking Listerine. She didn't have any communication with the outside world, and just like I used to do when I was drinking, she would become very contained. I would put duct tape up on the windows when I was drinking, because I didn't want people to see in, and I really didn't want to see you either, so I didn't want to see out. But my mother operated that way too. And I got it. I really understood that part of my mama. But my mother would have a good news club at our house. And when I was about in fourth grade and third grade, and everybody come over, and she'd tell them the good news. And the problem was I never got the good news. And But Mother was always carrying that word, you know. We talk about carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother was carrying that word, and I'm sure her prayers kept me alive some of those nights when I was out and doing what I did often, which was get drunk, not come home, have car accidents, boat accidents. I wrecked a motorcycle one time. But anyway, I was always up to that kind of stuff. But my mama was always pressing me to get reborn, you know. And I found a book not too long ago where I'd written in it. It was a Bible that my mama had, and it said I was reborn on June 1st, 1971. And I may have been reborn that day, but I'm telling you, my conduct afterwards didn't really prove that. So all of this, you know, responsible work on my mother's part couldn't get me sober. And my daddy was Episcopalian. And my father was a descendant of Clarence Darrow. My daddy believed in evolution, and he studied science, and my mother here had these other beliefs. So we always had kind of a divided household on some of those fronts. But I went to church with my mama and with my daddy, and after they divorced, I really didn't go to any kind of a religious institution. And when I got here and you started talking about God, all I knew was the God of my mama. And I didn't want that God, because that God hadn't really carried the water for me. And so I would impress upon people my belief system when they would bring up God. I would say to myself, I don't want to hear that word one more time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want the God that I knew, even though you weren't talking about that God, I thought you were talking about that God. And I didn't want to hear that God. So I was very put off and very careful not to use the word God for many, many years in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was higher power. What I came to know through good sponsorship was that it was a God of my understanding. And I came to have a relationship with a God of my understanding. Not the God of my mother, or the God of my daddy, or my brothers, or anybody else who'd tried to be of good assistance to me over those years. It was a God of my understanding. A very insightful piece of Alcoholics Anonymous for somebody like me, who was probably bordering on agnosticism. I'd be in jail and I'd think, well, this is the way things are going to go. I just got to manage them better. You know, got to have a good lawyer, boyfriend who owns land so he can sign the bond. And that's the way I planned ahead. Okay? So I'm growing up in Decatur, Alabama, and these guys and women from Tennessee, Connie, Steve, Mike, his wife, know when I was growing up, there weren't any legal distributors. You couldn't buy any liquor. You went to the bootlegger. A lot of Baptists back there, too, and they were voting down the referendums for legal alcohol sales. And so the good news about the bootlegger is they're, you know, they don't care how old you are. But they also want to know you, okay? So if they don't know you very well, they're not very friendly to you. They just shoot at your tires while you're outside their trailer, you know, telling you to get out. And so I had a good friend named Jane, and Jane's sisters were older than us. And anyway, we knew some bootleggers. But my best bootlegger was always Marvelline. And Marvelline was on the river, and I lived on right on the river. And we had a crummy boat. It's called the Tomato. It was bright orange, Chris Craft. Just tortured that boat. I didn't even know where the channel was. My father really didn't give us a lot of lessons, and we were able to boat before we had a driver's license. And we had a seniority system. I was the oldest, and my two younger brothers, and we just go out in that boat, and I'd tear things up, and you know Coast Guard, of course, knew our boat. We had the worst boat house in the harbor. Our boat house was sinking into the water like Saigon. You know, it's kind of just going down, 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 down. Everybody else would have these nice boat houses where they'd have their family come. And we had an old, really moldy refrigerator in there. And my daddy and I'd be back in the boat house, and my godfather, Rooster, and my daddy's friends, Goat, those were their names. They'd be down there at the boathouse, and my daddy'd say, hey, come on back here. And we'd get a few drinks, for Goat and Rooster and these guys, Mr. Eister. And my daddy, he'd dip it down and put the river water in it. And he'd say, "Okay, Edith, now go give these to them." And we'd both sit back there, my daddy, I was a little girl, and laugh. And I'd go take these gentlemen these drinks of scotch and river water. And still today, there's nothing I love more than a practical joking because of my old man. You know, even at my AA meeting, my home group is called the Mayflower. And you can, you know why? And we meet at 7:30 on 52nd Miami in Omaha, Nebraska. And just like Bruce was talking about, we have a great time at my home group. Everybody's laughing and we make fun of people and give them a hard time. And we got a lot of new people, and they come from the Salvation Army and from the Santa Francis House and from another treatment center called Nova. And we just have a great time. But at my meetings, I'll do things like I'll buy a bunch of those plastic flies and put them in the cake, you know, and I'll get a gal I sponsor, her son will sometimes come to the meeting, and then I'll say, "Okay, so let's put these flies in all the cake, but don't give them to any little bitty children because we don't want them to swallow them or anything. Just give them to the adults who, you know, will be taken aback by it." Anyway, that's the kind of thing I like to do. I called San, you know, and told her that I was in another town and we'd gotten lost. You know, that's just how I operate. But anyway, I'm down there at the river often with my daddy and I'm boating a lot. And down the river in Triana was Marvelline's trailer. And Marvelline, you could go down there and get a case of Schlitz for $6. Okay, that's from the bootlegger. That means that's a premium. So I'd be down there a lot on Sunday morning getting some beer. And, you know, we'd be out in the river and loving it. Out on the river, it's hard to catch you. And a few times we did get ticketed for reckless skiing. Or the Coast Guard would follow me back to the boat, you know, boathouse. And they'd be there and try to ticket us or arrest us. My younger brother said to me not too long ago, "You know, I remember you showing up at the boat dock," and he said, "I'd always have to wait because you had seniority because of your age." He said, "But it was really unfair because you and all your ne'er-do-well friends got off the boat," he said, "and then you handed me the steering wheel." I didn't remember that, but I'm sure it happened. So drinking to me looked pretty good at a young age. My parents both drank, and they had a liquor cabinet. And my father started locking it because I was into it and my mother was into it, and she was growing impaired as time passed. But I knew how to get in that liquor cabinet. After my daddy died in 2012, I found a bunch of old kind of really low-class liqueurs in that liquor cabinet and around the house, you know, like some kind of knockoff Kahlua or some low-class Irish whiskey that my daddy had kept and had around the house. Anyways, people were leaving after I had a big party after my daddy died at his house in honor of him, and we had a nice time. And sober people came, including Steve, which was a real honor to have my friends from Alcoholics Anonymous there at my father's funeral. But I would give people these bottles of whiskey, which were from like 1980, and say, "Shine wanted you to have this." As they were leaving at about 1:30 in the morning, "Shine wanted you to have this." Anyway, so my career started on the river, but it kept going. You know, I was in high school, and everything you'd see if you were in a helicopter and you were following me around, you'd say, "That girl's going to not have some good outcomes." You know what I mean? Kind of like my friend. Is Rose here? Where's Rose? What's Rose's husband was on the video, and Harlan cut him out with music. You know what I'm talking about? Where is he? Yeah, what's your name? Shane. Shane, did you notice how Harlan started the music while you were talking? Anyway, So Shane and I, if you're watching us in the helicopter, you would have said, the outcomes for these people are going to be abysmal, okay? That's how it was going. And I was a pretty good student when I went. But when I went to high school, we'd just drive up to I had a Pontiac Bonneville. Sweet, green, gold top. I loved it. Anyway, it went pretty fast. I had to pick up a few people, smoke a couple of joints on the way to high school, and then you drive up to the gravel parking lot, and we'd drink, and we'd go to high school. At night, I'd go to the Plush Horse in Huntsville, Alabama. You know where that is? Mike or your wife? It was a lower drinking age in Tennessee, so sometimes we'd go up to Tennessee to the Pioneer Club. But we'd go to the Plush Horse at night on school nights, and it was a lot of spotlights like you got here. And disco, you know, they'd have disco, and I'd wear a one-piece suit, you know, like a, what do you call those? Jumpsuit, yeah, like American Hustle. I didn't look like that gal, but wear those jumpsuits. I love that, dancing. Drinking, we were underage, and back then, to you young people, your IDs didn't have holograms on them. Just had brown eyes, 5'8", Edith Peebles, February 24, 1960, in my address, and you could manufacture anything you wanted from that, just take in somebody else's. So we would be clubbing at night. Always hard to get out of a jumpsuit on the highway. To use the bathroom. But anyway. So things were going along like this, and I was getting arrested in high school. And I'd drive and do this, and you know how we all do. But I had a real serious event when I was 17. Actually, I was 18. I was leaving the Plush Horse with my old friend Jane. And Jane was the kind of person you like to drink with, okay? Jane goes after it like I did. And Jane had just gotten out of a full body cast. And the reason she'd been in a full... And these were Place de Paris back then. And it was up to here. And Jane was in a full body cast for about 9 months because she'd been in a head-on collision drunk. And then she'd gotten out of the cast. She and I were drinking, taking a few other things. And we went to my house, got out of her Volkswagen Rabbit, got in my Pontiac Bonneville, and started driving. Went in, told my parents I was home. Went in and got in my car, and then we went out to Trinity, where she was from. We were going to go to another party. By now, it's about 3:30 in the morning, and we... I was the driver, and we unfortunately were on railroad tracks when a train was coming. So we were my car was coming across the track and hit by the train and fell over into a ravine. And a woman on her way to her job as a nurse, going to an early shift job at 6 in the morning, found us and got the EMT crew there, and she... probably saved our lives. Jane was thrown from the car, and if you ever seen my neck, my neck was cut open by the windshield. So I was in emergency surgery, and one of my parents' friends did the work, all this work. Guy B. Wilder, Dr. Wilder. I went to call everybody in his family when he passed away, thanking them for their father's service to me. And I was in a coma. And I didn't know what had happened. And when I came to, I saw a guy that I'd been going out with and my father. And the man that was a gentleman I'd been seeing, Tim, was sick. I saw him sick, and I knew that things were bad. I didn't know anything that had happened. And I was later told that Jane was in another hospital room. The great news for me is that Jane survived. She had a head injury, but she's alive. She says to me still that going over train tracks, she hears a ding, 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 ding. But she survived. But that's just the beginning of where it went for me. So that didn't even pose a small reflective moment on my part to quit drinking. I was drinking in the hospital on respiratory therapy. I had to stay up there and have respiratory therapy every day to get my lungs clear and my vocal cords repaired. I still sing, though, as some of you might have heard last night. I turned 21 in prison doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. But I still try to sing, even though I can't. But it doesn't matter to me. I just like to sing. So that's an old Merle Haggard tune, if anybody doesn't know who sings that, the great hag, who I love. But I was drinking in the hospital. As soon as I got out, everything was just like it used to be. And I continued that kind of a route straight to hell, I guess you'd say. And what happened to me was my father was pretty clear on who I was. And so he said, to the banker, don't negotiate any checks Edith has. She stole them from my business. He'd say to the guys that worked for him who had tow trucks because he had some gasoline stations, hey, Edith didn't come home for the last two nights. Go find her Lincoln Continental. I got a Lincoln Continental after the Bonneville. And that's a good car, too. You can put eight people in it. Know what I mean? Go a lot of places. We go down to Atlanta. Have a mirror in the back seat all the way across. That was a great car. Gasoline was cheap. Okay? So so my daddy would say, don't negotiate her checks. Tell the pawnbroker, if Edith brings any jewelry in, she stole it. Call me. And then he told his guys. He'd say, we hadn't seen Edith. I want you to drive around Decatur, find that car, tow it, and lock it up. Because he had a big lot on the river. He'd lock up the car. And it's always a hard day when you come out after two or three days inside and your car's gone, you know. And the people that you're with really don't have the time or the mind to give you a ride. They're just waiting for the coin you owe them, which they're going to come and seek out fast. So my father got it. My mother, on the other hand, was a soft touch, and she was always kind to me about that. And she'd reconsider, just like my great aunt, just like my grandmother. And but my daddy drove the hard line. He was a World War II veteran, just like Larsine talked about with her father. And my father had joined the Navy when he was underage, and my grandparents had underwritten him going in. And so on 1942, he was sworn in at Pearl Harbor. And he had been in the Navy, and he knew how to deal with somebody like me. My mama, again, it was hard on her. But I kept drinking. I graduated from high school. I was asked to leave my house. Started living at Jane's house. Sounded like a great idea to me because it was a little more liberal over there. People didn't have these hard and fast rules. And really, I didn't want to be a part of my family. It was too hard, okay? I didn't know. You know, I was the kind of sister who brought home cocaine and liquor for my younger brothers. I got them smoking pot. I mean, that's the kind of person that I was. I didn't further their good. They were embarrassed by me. You know, my father sat by Judge Straub every Sunday in the Episcopalian church because their mothers had two memorial windows right there at that pew. And my father would have to sit by this gentleman who had arraigned me the weekend before in a bikini with a T-shirt on that said, marijuana's nature's way of getting high, and disco sucks on the back, because I'd been picked up on the river. And if you want to talk about humiliation, I caused it to everybody in my family every day. I was loose. My brothers heard about it at school. I was in the newspaper, and that's the way my family had to live in a small town, having a daughter and a sister and a granddaughter like me. And you get a little bit of that when you move into parenthood, and I've been a step parent, and it's been a great blessing. But I remember my stepson, he was on the lam, man, just like me. And my husband and little Richard and my husband's wife, his ex-wife, and me were in this counseling session, and my stepson said, "You know, I could say anything to my mama and my daddy," he said, "but that damn Edith," he said, "she always knew what I was thinking." I said, "Yeah, baby, because you're just like me." My father's second wife died, and I was sober. And my daddy had been drinking all day. And I knew his heart was broken because Louise had died. And this is just like Steve said, you won't get a linear story here. Just stay with me in the pinball machine. And so my daddy's drinking all day. Louise has died. And I'm down there in South Alabama where my stepfamily lived. And I said, called up my brother. It was 2:30 in the morning. I'm out on Louise's couch, and I said, porch. And I said, "Dara, Daddy hadn't come home." I said, "I'm awful worried about him. I have 5 stepbrothers and sisters, now 4. One died, also a drinker." And I said, "Daddy hadn't come home all night, and it's 2:30 in the morning." And Dara said, "Serves your sorry ass right. You just sit right out there on that porch just like Daddy did all those nights waiting for you." And I knew what he was talking about. For a moment, I've been given the opportunity to see what kind of destruction you lay at the feet of all the people who are surrounding you, who care about you, love you. And even as recently as 3 years ago, I'm sitting on a porch in Florida with my oldest friend who I'd grown up with. And she is crying, speaking to me about the fear and hardship she had when we were younger, not knowing if I would live, and my absenteeism from her life, which was driven by my need to separate from people who cared about me, because I just did not have the equipment to be in any kind of intimate relationship with anybody. And so the damage still goes on, and like Chamberlain says, uncover, discover, discard. I'm still doing it today. I'm still making amends today for things I did back in the 80s. And that's one of those things, being a good friend, a true friend, a steady friend, which is exactly what Nell brought to the table today. When Nell was talking today, that's what I kept thinking. A quiet report of a steady member of Al-Anon, decade after decade after decade. What a privilege to have been here today and heard her. I hope you all did. If you didn't, you can buy her tape. And as she said, she's got 2 caretakers here, but one of them's really cheap, okay? I don't know if you caught that. He didn't want to take her out to dinner. Nell, I'll take you to dinner. Wherever you want to go, baby. So, anyway, I started working on a dairy farm because I didn't have any coin. And, you know, Jane's family's like, "We're getting tired of you and soon." And Jane and I would go work on it every morning. We got up at 5:30 in the morning. Jane would smoke 2 joints and drink 4 Miller Ponies on the way to work. And it was the hardest work I'd ever done, man. If you've done this kind of work, and we're in the area where you have, and my friend, formerly Shelby, what's your name? Shelby, what's your first miss? Used to be Shelby, and now you got a different last name. Anyway, you're Shane's sister-in-law. Yeah, okay. So Shane's sister-in-law knows about dairy farming because she works at Tillamook. So you got to clean the dairy with acidic solution. You got to load those milk buckets. I could barely carry one between both.